16-footer, and I'd practiced with it a lot. I could crack that rawhide popper louder than a gunshot. I could cut a branch as thick as my little finger off a green mesquite with it. But I couldn't stop those bulls from fighting. They were too mad. They were hurting too much already. I might as well have been spitting on them. I yelled and whipped them till I gave clear out. Still, they went right on with their roaring, bloody battle. I guess they would have kept on fighting till they leveled the house to the ground if it hadn't been for a freak accident. We had a heavy two-wheeled Mexican cart that Papa used for hauling wood and hay. It happened to be standing out in front of the house, right where the ground broke away in a sharp slant toward the spring and creek. It had just come to me that I could get my gun and shoot the bulls when Chongo crowded Roni up against the cart. He ran that long single horn clear under Roni's belly. Now he gave such a big heave that he lifted Roni's feet clear off the ground and rolled him in the air. A second later, Roni landed flat on his back inside the bed of that dump cart with all 4 feet sticking up. I thought his weight would break the cart to pieces, but I was wrong. The cart was stronger than I'd thought. All the bull's weight did was to tilt it so that the wheels started rolling, and away the cart went down the hill, carrying Roni with it. When that happened, Chongo was suddenly the silliest-looking bull you ever saw. He stood with his tail up and his head high, staring after the runaway cart. He couldn't for the life of him figure out what he'd done with the roan bull. The rolling cart rattled and banged and careened its way down the slope till it was right beside the spring. There, one wheel struck a big boulder, bouncing that side of the cart so high that it turned over and skidded to a stop. The roan bull spilled right into the spring. Water flew in all directions. Roni got his feet under him. He scrambled up out of the hole. But I guess that cart ride and sudden wetting had taken all the fight out of him. Anyhow, he headed for the timber, running with his tail tucked. Water streamed down out of his hair, leaving a dark, wet trail in the dry dust to show which way he'd gone. Chongo saw Roni then. He snorted and went after him. But when he got to the cart, he slid to a sudden stop. The cart, lying on its side now, still had that top wheel spinning around and around. Chongo had never seen anything like that. He stood and stared at the spinning wheel. He couldn't understand it. He lifted his nose up close to smell it. Finally, he reached out a long tongue to lick and taste it. That was a bad mistake. I guess the iron tire on the spinning wheel was roughed up pretty badly and maybe had chips of broken rock and gravel stuck to it. Anyhow, from the way Chongo acted, it must have scraped all the hide off his tongue. Chongo bawled and went running backwards. He whirled away so fast that he lost his footing and fell down. He came to his feet and took out in the opposite direction from the roan bull. He ran, slinging his head and flapping his long tongue around, bawling like he'd stuck it into a bear trap. He ran with his tail clamped just as tight as the roan bull's. It was enough to make you laugh your head off, the way both of those bad bulls had gotten the wits scared clear out of them, each one thinking he'd lost the fight. But they sure had made a wreck of the yard fence.
This book is continued on Disc 2. Disc 2.
Chapter 5. That little Arliss, if he wasn't a mess. From the time he'd grown up big enough to get out of the cabin, he'd made a practice of trying to catch and keep every living thing that ran, flew, jumped, or crawled. Every night, before Mama let him go to bed, she'd make Arliss empty his pockets of whatever he'd captured during the day. Generally, it would be a tangled-up mess of grasshoppers and worms and praying bugs and little rusty tree lizards. One time, he brought in a horned toad that got so mad he swelled out round and flat as a Mexican tortilla and bled at the eyes. Sometimes it was stuff like a young bird that had fallen out of its nest before it could fly, or a green speckled spring frog, or a striped water snake. And once it turned out of his pocket a wadded-up baby copperhead that nearly threw Mama into spasms. We never did figure out why the snake hadn't bitten him, but Mama took no more chances on snakes. She switched Arliss hard for catching that snake. Then she made me spend better than a week taking him out and teaching him to throw rocks and kill snakes. That was all right with little Arliss. If Mama wanted him to kill his snakes first, he'd kill them. But that still didn't keep him from sticking them in his pockets, along with everything else he'd captured that day. The snakes might be stinking by the time Mama called on him to empty his pockets, but they'd be dead. Then, after the yeller dog came, little Arliss started catching even bigger game, like cottontail rabbits and chaparral birds and a baby possum that sulked and lay like dead for the first several hours until he finally decided that Arliss wasn't going to hurt him. Of course, it was old Yeller that was doing the catching. He'd run the game down and turn it over to little Arliss. Then little Arliss could come in and tell Mama a big fib about how he caught it himself. I watched them one day when they caught a blue catfish out of Birdsong Creek. The fish had fed out into water so shallow that his top fin was sticking out. About the time I saw it, old Yeller and little Arliss did too. They made a run at it. The fish went scooting away toward deeper water, only Yeller was too fast for him. He pounced on the fish and shut his big mouth down over it and went romping to the bank, where he dropped it down on the grass and let it flop. And here came little Arliss to fall on it like I guess he'd been doing everything else. The minute he got his hands on it, the fish finned him, and he went to crying. But he wouldn't turn the fish loose. He just grabbed it up and went running and squalling toward the house, where he gave the fish to Mama. His hands were all bloody by then where the fish had finned him. They swelled up and got mighty sore. Not even a mesquite thorn hurts as bad as a sharp fish fin when it's run deep into your hand. But as soon as Mama had wrapped his hands in a poultice of mashed-up prickly pear root to draw out the poison, little Arliss forgot all about his hurt. And that night, when we ate the fish for supper, he told the biggest windy I ever heard about how he dived way down into a deep hole under the rocks and dragged that fish out and nearly got drowned before he could swim to the bank with it. When I tried to tell Mama what really happened, she wouldn't let me. "Now, this is Arliss's story," she said. "You let him tell it the way he wants to." I told Mama then. I said, "Mama, that old yeller dog is going to make the biggest liar in Texas out of little Arliss." But Mama just laughed at me, like she always laughed at little Arliss's big windies after she'd gotten off where he couldn't hear her. She said for me to let little Arliss alone. She said that if he ever told a bigger whopper than the ones I used to tell, she had yet to hear it. Well, I hushed then. If Mama wanted little Arliss to grow up to be the biggest liar in Texas, I guess it wasn't any of my business. All of which, I figure, is what led up to little Arliss's catching the bear. I think Mama had let him tell so many big yarns about his catching live game that he'd begun to believe them himself. When it happened, I was down the creek a ways, splitting rails to fix up the yard fence where the bulls had torn it down. I'd been down there since dinner, working in a stand of tall, slim post oaks. I'd chop down a tree, trim off the branches as far up as I wanted, then cut away the rest at the top. After that, I'd start splitting the log. I'd split the log by driving steel wedges into the wood. I'd start at the big end and hammer in a wedge with the back side of my axe. This would start a little split running lengthways of the log. Then I'd take a second wedge and drive it into this split. This would split the log further along, and at the same time loosen the first wedge. I'd then knock the first wedge loose and move it up in front of the second one. Driving one wedge ahead of the other like that, I could finally split a log in two halves. Then I'd go to work on the halves, splitting them apart. That way, from each log, I'd come out with four rails. Swinging that chopping axe was sure hard work. The sweat poured off me. My back muscles ached. The axe got so heavy I could hardly swing it. My breath got harder and harder to breathe. An hour before sundown, I was worn down to a nub. Seemed like I couldn't hit another lick. Papa could have lasted till past sundown, but I didn't see how I could. I shouldered my axe and started toward the cabin, trying to think up some excuse to tell Mama to keep her from knowing I was played clear out. That's when I heard little Arliss scream. Well, little Arliss was a screamer by nature. He'd scream when he was happy and scream when he was mad, and a lot of times he'd scream just to hear himself make a noise. Generally, we paid no more mind to his screaming than we did to the gobble of a wild turkey. But this time was different. The second I heard his screaming, I felt my heart flop clear over. This time I knew little Arliss was in real trouble. I tore out up the trail leading toward the cabin. A minute before, I'd been so tired out with my rail splitting that I couldn't have struck a trot. But now I raced through the tall trees in that creek bottom, covering ground like a scared wolf. Little Arliss's second scream, when it came, was louder and shriller and more frantic sounding than the first. Mixed with it was a whimpering, crying sound that I knew didn't come from him. It was a sound I'd heard before, and seemed like I ought to know what it was. But right then I couldn't place it. Then, from way off to one side came a sound that I would have recognized anywhere. It was the coughing roar of a charging bear. I'd just heard it once in my life. That was the time Mama had shot and wounded a hog-killing bear, and Papa had had to finish it off with a knife to keep it from getting her. My heart went to pushing up into my throat, nearly choking off my wind. I strained for every lick of speed I could get out of my running legs. I didn't know what sort of fix little Arliss had got himself into, but I knew that it had to do with a mad bear, which was enough. The way the late sun slanted through the trees had the trail all cross-banded with streaks of bright light and dark shade. I ran through these bright and dark patches so fast that the changing light nearly blinded me. Then suddenly, I raced out into the open where I could see ahead. And what I saw sent a chill clear through to the marrow of my bones. There was little Arliss down in that spring hole again. He was lying half in and half out of the water, holding onto the hind leg of a little black bear cub no bigger than a small coon. the bear cub was out on the bank, whimpering and crying and clawing the rocks with all three of his other feet, trying to pull away. But little Arliss was holding on for all he was worth, scared now and screaming his head off, too scared to let go. How the bear cub ever came to prowl close enough for little Arliss to grab him, I don't know. And why it didn't turn on him and bite loose, I couldn't figure out either. Unless he was like little Arliss, too scared to think. But all of that didn't matter now. What mattered was the bear cub's mama. She'd heard the cries of her baby and was coming to save him. She was coming so fast that she had the brush popping and breaking as she crashed through and over it. I could see her black, heavy figure piling off down the slant on the far side of Birdsong Creek. She was roaring mad and ready to kill. And worst of all, I could see that I'd never get there in time. Mama couldn't either. She'd heard Arliss, too, and here she came from the cabin, running down the slant toward the spring, screaming at Arliss, telling him to turn the bear cub loose. But little Arliss wouldn't do it. All he'd do was hang with that hind leg and let out one shrill shriek after another as fast as he could suck in a breath. Now the she-bear was charging across the shallows in the creek. She was knocking sheets of water high in the bright sun, charging with her fur up and her long teeth bared, filling the canyon with that awful coughing roar. And no matter how fast Mama ran or how fast I ran, the she-bear was going to get there first. I think I nearly went blind then, picturing what was going to happen to little Arliss. I know that I opened my mouth to scream, and not any sound came out. Then, just as the bear went lunging up the creek bank toward little Arliss and her cub, a flash of yellow came streaking out of the brush. It was that big yellow dog. He was roaring like a mad bull. He wasn't one-third as big and heavy as the she-bear, but when he piled into her from one side, he rolled her clear off her feet. They went down in a wild, roaring tangle of twisting bodies and scrambling feet and slashing fangs. As I raced past them, I saw the bear lunge up to stand on her hind feet like a man while she clawed at the body of the yeller dog hanging to her throat. I didn't wait to see more. Without ever checking my stride, I ran in and jerked little Arliss loose from the cub. I grabbed him by the wrist and yanked him up out of that water and slung him toward Mama like he was a half-empty sack of corn. I screamed at Mama, "Grab him, Mama! Grab him and run!" Then I swung my chopping axe high and wheeled, aiming to cave in the she-bear's head with the first lick. But I never did strike. I didn't need to. Old Yeller hadn't let the bear get close enough. He couldn't handle her. She was too big and strong for that. She'd stand there on her hind feet, hunched over, and take a roaring swing at him with one of those big front claws. She'd slap him head over heels. She'd knock him so far that it didn't look like he could possibly get back there before she charged again. But he always did. He'd hit the ground rolling, yelling his head off with the pain of the blow. But somehow he'd always rolled to his feet, and here he'd come again, ready to tie into her for another round. I stood there with my axe raised, watching them for a long moment. Then, from up toward the house, I heard Mama calling, "Come away from that, Travis! Hurry, son, run!" That spooked me. Up till then, I'd been ready to tie into that bear myself. Now, suddenly, I was scared out of my wits again. I ran toward the cabin. But like it was, old Yeller nearly beat me there. I didn't see it, of course, but Mama said that the minute old Yeller saw we were all in the clear and out of danger, he threw the fight to that she-bear and lit out for the house. The bear chased him for a little piece. But at the rate old Yeller was leaving her behind, Mama said it looked like the bear was backing up. But if the big yeller dog was scared or hurt in any way when he came dashing into the house, he didn't show it. He sure didn't show it like we all did. Little Arliss had hushed his screaming, but he was trembling all over and clinging to Mama like he'd never let her go. And Mama was sitting in the middle of the floor, holding him up close and crying like she'd never stop. And me, I was close to crying myself. Old Yeller, though, all he did was come bounding in to jump on us and lick us in the face and bark so loud that there, inside the cabin, the noise nearly made us deaf. The way he acted, you might have thought that bear fight hadn't been anything more than a rowdy romp that we'd all taken part in for the fun of it. Chapter 6. Till little Arliss got us mixed up in that bear fight, I guess I'd been looking on him about like most boys look on their little brothers. I liked him all right, but I didn't have a lot of use for him. What with his always playing in our drinking water and getting in the way of my chopping axe and howling his head off and chunking me with rocks when he got mad, it didn't seem to me like he was hardly worth the bother of putting up with. But that day when I saw him in the spring, so helpless against the angry she-bear, I learned different. I knew then that I loved him as much as I did Mama and Papa, maybe in some ways even a little bit more. So it was only natural for me to come to love the dog that saved him. After that, I couldn't do enough for Old Yeller. What if it was a big, ugly, meat-stealing rascal? What if it did fall over and yell bloody murder every time I looked crossways at him? What if it had run off when he ought to have helped with the fighting bulls? None of that made a lick of difference now. He'd pitched in and saved little Arliss when I couldn't possibly have done it. And that was enough for me. I petted him and made over him till he was wiggling all over to show how happy he was. I felt mean about how I treated him and did everything I could to let him know. I searched his feet and pulled out a long mesquite thorn that had become embedded between his toes. I held him down and had Mama hand me a stick with a coal of fire on it so I could burn off 3 big bloated ticks that I found inside one of his ears. I washed him with lye soap and water, then rubbed salty bacon grease into his hair all over to rout the fleas. And that night, after dark, when he sneaked into bed with me and little Arliss, I let him sleep there and never said a word about it to Mama. I took him and little Arliss squirrel hunting the next day. It was the first time I'd ever taken little Arliss on any kind of hunt. He was such a noisy pest that I always figured he'd scare off the game. As it turned out, he was just as noisy and pesky as I'd figured. He'd follow along, keeping quiet, like I told him, till he saw maybe a pretty butterfly floating around in the air. Then he'd set up a yell you could have heard a mile off and go chasing after the butterfly. Of course, he couldn't catch it, but he would keep yelling at me to come help him. Then he'd get mad because I wouldn't and yell still louder. Or maybe he'd stop to turn over a flat rock. Then he'd stand yelling at me to come back and look at all the yeller ants and centipedes and crickets and stinging scorpions that went scurrying away, hunting new hiding places. Once he got hung up in some briars and yelled till I came back to get him out. Another time he fell down and struck his elbow on a rock and didn't say a word about it for several minutes, until he saw blood seeping out of a cut on his arm. Then he stood and screamed like he was being burnt with a hot iron. With that much racket going on, I knew we'd scare all the game clear out of the country, which I guess we did. All but the squirrels. They took to the trees where they could hide from us. But I was lucky enough to see which tree one squirrel went up, so I put some of little Arliss's racket to use. I sent him in a circle around the tree, beating on the grass and bushes with a stick while I stood waiting. Sure enough, the squirrel got to watching little Arliss and forgot me. He kept turning around the tree limb to keep it between him and little Arliss till he was on my side in plain sight. I shot him out of the tree the first shot. After that, Old Yeller caught on to what game we were after. He went to work then, trailing and treeing the squirrels that little Arliss was scaring up off the ground. From then on, with Yeller to tree the squirrels and little Arliss to turn them on the tree limbs, we had pickings. It wasn't but a little bit till I'd shot five, more than enough to make us a good squirrel fry for supper. A week later, Old Yeller helped me catch a wild gobbler that I'd have lost without him. We had gone up to the corn patch to pick a bait of black-eyed peas. I was packing my gun. Just as we got up to the slab rock fence that Papa had built around the corn patch, I looked over and spotted this gobbler doing our pea picking for us. The pea pods were still green yet, most of them no further along than snapping size. This made them hard for the gobbler to shell, but he was working away at it, pecking and scratching so hard that he was raising a big dust out in the field. "Why, that old rascal," Mama said, "he's just clawing those pea vines all to pieces." "Hush, Mama," I said, "don't scare him." I lifted my gun and laid the barrel across the top of the rock fence. "I'll have him ready for the pot in just a minute." It wasn't a long shot, and I had him sighted in dead to rights. I aimed to stick a bullet right where his wings hinged to his back. I was holding my breath and already squeezing off when little Arliss, who'd gotten behind, came running up. "What you shooting at, Travis?" he yelled at the top of his voice. "What you shooting at?" Well, that made me and the gobbler both jump. The gun fired, and I saw the gobbler go down. But a second later, he was up again, streaking through the tall corn, dragging a broken wing. For a second, I was so mad at little Arliss, I could have wrung his neck like a frying chicken's. I said, "Arliss, why can't you keep your mouth shut? You made me lose that gobbler." Well, little Arliss didn't have sense enough to know what I was mad about. Right away, he puckered up and went to crying and leaking tears all over the place. Some of them splattered clear down on his bare feet, making dark splotches in the dust that covered them. I always did say that when little Arliss cried, he could shed more tears faster than any crier I ever saw. "Wait a minute," Mama put in. "I don't think you've lost your gobbler yet. Look yonder." She pointed, and I looked. And there was Old Yeller jumping the rock fence and racing toward the pea patch. He ran up to where I'd knocked the gobbler down. He circled the place one time, smelling the ground and wiggling his stub tail. Then he took off through the corn the same way the gobbler went, yelling like I was beating him with a stick. When he barked, treed, a couple of minutes later, it was in the woods the other side of the corn patch. We went to him. We found him jumping at the gobbler that had run up a stooping live oak and was perched there, panting, just waiting for me. So in spite of the fact that little Arliss had caused me to make a bad shot, we had us a real sumptuous supper that night. Roast turkey with cornbread dressing and watercress and wild onions that little Arliss and I found growing down in the creek next to the water. But when we tried to feed Old Yeller some of the turkey, on account of his saving us from losing it, he wouldn't eat. He'd lick the meat and wiggle his stub tail to show how grateful he was, but he didn't swallow down more than a bite or two. That puzzled Mama and me, because when we remembered back, we realized that he hadn't been eating anything we'd fed him for the last several days. Yet he was fat, and with hair as slick and shiny as a dog eating 3 square meals a day. Mama shook her head. "If I didn't know better," she said, "I'd say that dog was sucking eggs. But I got 3 hens setting, and 1 with bitty chickens, and I'm getting more eggs from the rest of them than I've gotten since last fall. So we can't be robbing the nests." Well, we wondered some about what Old Yeller was living on, but didn't worry about it. That is, not until the day Bud Searcy dropped by the cabin to see how we were making out. Bud Searcy was a red-faced man with a bulging middle who liked to visit around the settlement and sit and talk hard times and spit tobacco juice all over the place and wait for somebody to ask him to dinner. I never did have a lot of use for him, and my folks didn't either. Mama said he was shiftless. She said that was the reason the rest of the men left him at home to sort of look after the women folks and kids while they were gone on the cow drive. She said the men knew that if they took Bud Searcy along, they'd never get to Kansas before the steers were dead with old age. It'd take Searcy that long to get through visiting and eating with everybody between Salt Licks and Abilene. But he did have a little white-haired granddaughter that I sort of liked. She was 11 and different from most girls. She would hang around and watch what boys did, like showing how high they could climb in a tree, or how far they could throw a rock, or how fast they could swim, or how good they could shoot. But she never wanted to mix in or try to take over and boss things. She just went along and watched and didn't say much, and the only thing I had against her was her eyes. They were big, solemn brown eyes, and right pretty to look at. Only when she fixed them on me, it always seemed like they looked clear through me and saw everything I was thinking. That always made me sort of jumpy, so that when I could, I never would look right straight at her. Her name was Lizbeth, and she came with her grandpa the day he visited us. They came riding up on an old shad-bellied pony that didn't look like he'd had a fill of corn in a coon's age. She rode behind her grandpa's saddle, holding to his belt in the back, and her white hair was all curly and rippling in the sun. Trotting behind them was a blue-ticked she-dog that I always figured was one of Belle's pups. Old Yeller went out to bay them as they rode up. I noticed right off that he didn't go about it like he really meant business. His yelling bay sounded a lot more like he was just barking because he figured that's what we expected him to do. And the first time I hollered at him, telling him to dry up all that racket, he hushed, which surprised me, as hard-headed as he generally was. By the time Mama had come to the door and told Searcy and Lizbeth to get down and come right in, Old Yeller had started a romp with the blue-ticked bitch. Lizbeth slipped to the ground and stood staring at me with those big, solemn eyes, while her grandpa dismounted. Searcy told Mama that he believed he wouldn't come in the house. He said that, as hot as the day was, he figured he'd like it better sitting in the dog run. So Mama had me bring out our 4 cowhide bottom chairs. Circe picked the one I always liked to sit in best. He got out a twist of tobacco and bit off a chaw big enough to bulge his cheek, and went to chewing and talking and spitting juice right where we'd all be bound to step in it and pack it around on the bottoms of our feet. First he asked Mama if we were making out all right, and Mama said we were. Then he told her that he'd been left to look after all the families while the men were gone, a mighty heavy responsibility that was nearly working him to death, but that he was glad to do it. He said for Mama to remember that if the least little thing went wrong, she was to get in touch with him right away. And Mama said she would. Then he leaned his chair back against the cabin wall and went on telling what all was going on around in the settlement. He told about how dry the weather was, and how he looked for all the corn crops to fail, and the settlement folks to be scraping the bottoms of their meal barrels long before next spring. He told how the cows were going dry, and the gardens were failing. He told how Jed Simpson's boy Rosal was sitting at a turkey roost, waiting for a shot, when a fox came right up and tried to jump on him, and Rosal had to club it to death with his gun butt. This sure looked like a case of hydrophobia to Circe, as anybody knew that no fox in his right mind was going to jump on a hunter. Which reminded him of an uncle of his that got mad dog bit down in the piney woods of East Texas. This was way back when Circe was a little boy. As soon as the dog bit him, the man knew he was bound to die. So he went and got a big log chain and tied one end around the bottom of a tree and the other one to one of his legs. And right there he stayed till the sickness got him and he lost his mind. He slobbered at the mouth and moaned and screamed and ran at his wife and children, trying to catch them and bite them. Only, of course, the chain around his leg held him back, which was the reason he'd chained himself to the tree in the first place. And right there, chained to that tree, he finally died, and they buried him under the same tree. Bud Circe sure hoped that we wouldn't have an outbreak of hydrophobia in Salt Licks and all die before the men got back from Kansas. Then he talked a while about a panther that had caught and killed one of Joe Anson's colts, and how the Anson boys had put their dogs on the trail. They ran the panther into the cave, and Jeff Anson followed in where the dogs had more sense than to go and got pretty badly panther mauled for his trouble. But it did get the panther. Circe talked till dinner time, said not a word all through dinner, and then went back to talking as quick as he'd swallowed down the last bite. He told how some strange varmint that wasn't a coyote, possum, skunk, or coon had recently started robbing the settlement blind. Or maybe it was even somebody. Nobody could tell for sure. All they knew was that they were losing meat out of their smokehouses, eggs out of their hens' nests, and sometimes even whole pans of cornbread that the women folks had set out to cool. Ike Fuller had been barbecuing some meat over an open pit and left it for a minute to go get a drink of water, and came back to find that a 3 or 4 pound chunk of beef ribs had disappeared like it had gone up in smoke. Salt Lick's folks were getting pretty riled about it, Circe said, and guessed it would go hard with whatever, or whoever, was doing the raiding, if they ever learned what it was. Listening to this, I got an uneasy feeling. The feeling got worse a minute later when Lisbeth motioned me to follow her off down to the spring. We walked clear down there, with old Yeller and the blue tick dog following with us, before she finally looked up at me and said, "It's him." "What do you mean?" I said. "I mean it's your big Yeller dog," she said. "I saw him." "Do what?" I asked. "Steal that bait of ribs," she said. "I saw him get a bunch of eggs, too, from one of our nests." I stopped then and looked straight at her, and she looked straight back at me, and I couldn't stand it and had to look down. "But I'm not going to tell," she said. I didn't believe her. "I bet you do," I said. "No, I won't," she said, shaking her head. "I wouldn't, even before I knew he was your dog."
"Why?"
"Because Miss Prissy is going to have pups."
"Miss Prissy?"
"That's the name of my dog, and she's going to have pups, and your dog will be their papa, and I wouldn't want their papa to get shot."
I stared at her again, and again I had to look down. I wanted to thank her, but I didn't know the right words. So I fished around in my pocket and brought out an Indian arrowhead that I'd found the day before and gave that to her. She took it and stared at it for a little bit, with her eyes shining, then shoved it deep into a long pocket she had sewn to her dress.
"I won't never, never tell," she said,
then whirled and tore out for the house, running as fast as she could. I went down and sat by the spring a while. It seemed like I liked Bud Searcy a lot better than I ever had before, even if he did talk too much and spit tobacco juice all over the place. But I was still bothered. If Lisbeth had caught old Yeller stealing stuff at the settlement, then somebody else might too. And if they did, they were sure liable to shoot him. A family might put up with one of its own dogs stealing from them, if he was a good dog. But for a dog that left home to steal from everybody else, well, I didn't see much chance for him if he ever got caught. After Bud Searcy had eaten a hearty supper and talked a while longer, he finally rode off home, with Lisbeth riding behind him. I went then and gathered the eggs and held three back. I called old Yeller off from the house and broke the eggs on a flat rock right under his nose and tried to get him to eat them. But he wouldn't. He acted like he'd never heard tell that eggs were fit to eat. All he'd do was stand there and wiggle his tail and try to lick me in the face. It made me mad. "You thieving rascal," I said. "I ought to get a club and break your back in 14 different places." But I didn't really mean it, and I didn't say it loud and ugly. I knew that if I did, he'd fall over and start yelling like he was dying, and there I'd be in a fight with little Arliss again. "When they shoot you, I'm going to laugh," I told him. But I knew that I wouldn't. Chapter 7. I did considerable thinking on what Lisbeth Searcy had told me about old Yeller, and finally went and told Mama. "Why, that old rogue," she said. "We'll have to try to figure some way to keep him from prowling. Everybody in the settlement will be mad at us if we don't." "Somebody'll shoot him," I said. "Try tying him," she said. So I tried tying him, but we didn't have any baling wire in those days, and he could chew through anything else before you could turn your back. I tied him with rope, and then with big, thick rawhide string that I cut from a cowhide hanging across the top rail of the yard fence. It was the same thing in both cases. By the time we could get off to bed, he'd done chewed them in two and was gone. "Let's try the corn crib," Mama said on the third night. Which was a good idea that might have worked if it hadn't been for little Arliss. I took old Yeller out and put him in the corn crib, and the second that he heard the door shut on him, he set up a yelling and a howling that brought little Arliss on the run. Mama and I both tried to explain to him why we needed to shut the dog up, but little Arliss was too mad to listen. You can't explain things very well to somebody who is screaming his head off and chunking you with rocks as fast as he can pick them up. So that didn't work either. Well, it looks like we're stumped, Mama said. I thought for a minute and said, No, Mama. I believe we've got one other chance. That's to shut him up in the same room with me and little Arliss every night. But he'll sleep in the bed with you boys, Mama said. And the first thing you know, you'll both be scratching fleas and having mange and breaking out with ringworms. No, I'll put a cowhide on the floor and make him sleep there, I said. So Mama agreed. And I spread a cowhide on the floor beside our bed, and we shut old Yeller in and didn't have a bit more trouble. Of course, old Yeller didn't sleep on the cowhide. And once, a good while later, I did break out with a little ringworm under my left arm, but I rubbed it with turpentine just like Mama always did, and it soon went away. And after that, when we fed old Yeller corn meal mush or fresh meat, he ate it and did well on it, and never one time bothered our chicken nests. About that time, too, the varmints got to pestering us so much that a lot of times old Yeller and I were kept busy nearly all night long. It was the coons, mainly. The corn was ripening into roasting ears now, and the coons would come at night and strip the shucks back with their little hands and gnaw the milky kernels off the cob. Also, the watermelons were beginning to turn red inside, and the skunks would come and open up little round holes in the rinds and reach in with their forefeet and drag out the juicy insides to eat. Sometimes coyotes would come and eat watermelons, too. And now and then a deer would jump into the field and eat corn, melons, and peas. So old Yeller and I took to sleeping in the corn patch every night. We slept on the cowhide that Yeller never would sleep on at the house. That is, we did when we got to sleep. Most of the night we'd be up fighting coons. We slept out in the middle of the patch, where Yeller could send a coon clear to the fence on every side. We'd lie there on the cowhide and look up at the stars and listen to the warm night breeze rustling the corn blades. Sometimes I'd wonder what the stars were and what kept them hanging up there so high and bright. And if Papa, way off up yonder in Kansas, could see the same stars I could see. I was getting mighty lonesome to see Papa. With the help of old Yeller, I was taking care of things all right, but I was sure beginning to wish that he'd come back home. Then I'd think a while about the time when I'd get big enough to go off on a cow drive myself, ride my own horse, and see all the big new country of plains and creeks and rivers and mountains and timber and new towns and Indian camps. Then, finally, just about the time I started drifting off to sleep, I'd hear old Yeller rise to his feet and go padding off through the corn. A minute later, his yelling bay would lift from some part of the corn patch, and I'd hear the fighting squall of some coon caught stealing corn. Then I'd jump to my feet and go running through the corn, shouting encouragement to old Yeller. Get him, Yeller, I'd holler. Tear him up! And that's what old Yeller would be trying to do. But a boar coon isn't an easy thing to tear up. For one thing, he'll fight you from sundown till sun up. He's not big for size, but but the longer you fight him, the bigger his seems to get. He fights you with all 4 feet and every tooth in his head, and enough courage for an animal 5 times his size. On top of that, he's fighting inside a thick hide that fills a dog's mouth like a wad of loose sacking. The dog has a hard time ever really biting him. He just squirms and twists around inside that hide and won't quit fighting even after the dog's got enough and is ready to throw the fight to him. Plenty of times, Papa and I had seen a boar coon whip Belle, run him off, then turn on us and chase us clear out of a cornfield. It was easy for me to go running through the dark cornfields, yelling for Old Yeller to tear up a thieving coon. But it wasn't easy for Old Yeller to do it. He'd be yelling, and the coon would be squalling, and they'd go wallowing and clawing and threshing through the corn, popping the stalks as they broke them off, making such an uproar in the night that it sounded like murder. But generally, when the fight was all over, the coon went one way and Old Yeller the other, both of them pretty well satisfied to call it quits. We didn't get much sleep of a night while all this was going on, but we had us a good time and saved the corn from the coon. The only real bad part of it was the skunks. What with all the racket we made coon fighting, the skunks didn't come often. But when one did come, we were in a mess. Old Yeller could handle a skunk easy enough. All he had to do was rush in, grab it by the head, and give it a good shaking. That would break the skunk's neck. But it wouldn't end the trouble. Because not even a hoot owl can kill a skunk without getting sprayed with his scent. And skunk scent is a smell that won't quit. After every skunk killing, Old Yeller would get so sick that he could hardly stand it. He'd snort and drool and slobber and vomit. He'd roll and wallow in the dirt and go dragging his body through tall weeds, trying to get the scent off. But he couldn't. Then finally, he'd give up and come lie down on the cowhide with me. And of course, he'd smell so bad that I couldn't stand him and have to go off and try to sleep somewhere else. Then he'd follow me and get his feelings hurt because I wouldn't let him sleep with me. Papa always said that breathing skunk scent was the best way in the world to cure a head cold. But this was summertime when Old Yeller and I didn't have head colds. We would just as soon that the skunks stayed out of the watermelons and let us alone. Working there night after night, guarding our precious bread corn from the varmints, I came to see what I would have been up against if I'd had it to do without the help of Old Yeller. By myself, I'd have been run to death and still probably wouldn't have saved the corn. Also, look at all the fun I would have missed if I'd been alone and how lonesome I would have been. I had to admit, Papa had been right when he told me how bad I needed a dog. I saw that even more clearly when the spotted heifer had her first calf. Our milk cows were all old-time longhorn cattle and didn't give a lot of milk. It was real hard to find one that would give much more than her calf could take. What we generally had to do was milk 5 or 6 cows to get enough milk for just the family. But we had one crumpled horn cow named Rose that gave a lot of milk. Only she was getting old, and Mama kept hoping that each of her heifer calves would turn out to be as good a milker as Rose. Mama had tried 2 or 3, but none of them proved to be any good. And then along came this spotted one that was just raw-boned and ugly enough to make a good milk cow. She had the bag for it, too. And Mama was certain this time that she'd get a milk cow to replace Rose. The only trouble was this heifer, Spot, as we called her, had been snaky wild from the day she was born. Tried to drive her with the other cattle, and she'd run off and hide. Hem her up in the corner and try to get your hands on her, and she'd turn on you and make fight. Mama had been trying all along to get Spot gentled before she had her first calf, but it was no use. Spot didn't want to be friends with anybody. We knew she was going to give us a pile of trouble when we set out to milk her. I failed to find Spot with the rest of our milk cows one evening, and when I went to drive them up the next day, she was still gone. "It's time for her to calve," Mama said, "and I'll bet she's got one." So, the next morning, I went further back in the hills and searched all over. I finally came across her, holed up in a dense thicket of bee myrtle, close to a little seep spring. I got one brief glimpse of a wobbly, long-legged calf before Spot snorted and took after me. She ran me clear to the top of the next high ridge before she turned back. I made another try. I got to the edge of the thicket and picked me up some rocks. I went to hollering and chunking into the brush, trying to scare her and the calf out. I got her out all right. But she wasn't scared. She came straight for me with her horns lowered, bawling her threats as she came. I had to turn tail a second time, and again she chased me clear to the top of that ridge. I tried it one more time, then went back to the house and got old Yeller. I didn't know if he knew anything about driving cattle or not, but I was willing to bet that he could keep her from chasing me. And he did. I went up to the edge of the thicket and started hollering and chunking rocks into it. Here came the heifer, madder than ever it looked like. I yelled at old Yeller. "Get her, Yeller," I hollered. And Yeller got her. He pulled the neatest trick I ever saw a dog pull on a cow brute. Only I didn't see it the first time. I was getting away from there too fast. I'd stumbled and fallen to my knees when I turned to run from Spot's charge, and she was too close behind for me to be looking back and watching what old Yeller was doing. I just heard the scared bawl she let out and the crashing of the brush as old Yeller rolled her into it. I ran a piece further, then looked back. The heifer was scrambling to her feet in a cloud of dust and looking like she didn't know any more about what had happened than I did. Then she caught sight of old Yeller. She snorted, stuck her tail in the air, and made for him. Yeller ran like he was scared to death, then cut back around a thicket. A second later, he was coming in behind Spot. Without making a sound, he ran up beside her, made his leap, and set his teeth in her nose. I guess it was the weight of him that did it. I saw him do it lots of times later, but never did quite understand how. Anyway, he just set his teeth in her nose, doubled himself up in a tight ball, and swung on. That turned the charging heifer a flip. Her heels went straight up in the air over her head. She landed flat on her back, with all four feet sticking up. She hit the ground so hard that it sounded like she ought to bust wide open. I guess she felt that way about it, too. Anyhow, after taking that second fall, she didn't have much fight left in her. She just scrambled to her feet and went trotting back into the thicket, lowing to her calf. I followed her, with old Yeller beside me, and we drove her out and across the hills to the cow lot. Not one time did she turn on us again. She did try to run off a couple of times, but all I had to do was send old Yeller in to head her. and the second she caught sight of him, she couldn't turn fast enough to get headed back in the right direction. It was the same when we got her into the cow pen. Her bag was all in a strut with milk that the calf couldn't hold. Mama said we needed to get that milk out. She came with a bucket, and I took it, knowing I had me a big kicking fight on my hands if I ever hoped to get any milk. The kicking fight started. The first time I touched Spot's